Welcome to the Anchor Church Podcast. Each week, we'll bring you the teaching from our central campus. We hope it's an encouragement to you. Thanks for listening.
Well, we're in a fun season, as Pete mentioned just a little while ago, this Good Grows Here season that we're stepping into. And this is the second to last week in our Good Grows Here teaching series. Next week is significant, but we're really setting it up today, looking at John chapter 12. If you're new with us, and maybe you missed how Pete explained it earlier, Good Grows Here is really us sensing the Lord leading us in faith toward turning this place into a kids' ministry space and building a new sanctuary on the field. Massive, significant. We're going to be picking it up in John chapter 12. If you have a Bible, you can open to it. We're reading the first 11 verses. It'll also be up on the screen. And it begins like this. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here, a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served, while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. And then Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume, and she poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief, as a keeper of the money bag, and he used to help himself to what was put into it. Leave her alone, Jesus replied. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. Poor Lazarus. He just got back. They're trying to kill him again. This poor guy. For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing him. We're talking about extravagance today. No one ever says right after they propose. You can imagine this. Those of you that are married, get on the knee, you propose, and then you comment on how you got a real steal on this ring. Can you imagine that? Yeah. Hey, take a look. Yeah, you'll see that it's actually the carrots. It's not quite what I wanted, but it was on clearance, and so I figured you'd appreciate my thriftiness on that. Can you imagine that? When something matters, maybe you've noticed this. When something matters, we reach for extravagance. A wedding is objectively impractical. Would you agree? Thousands of dollars for flowers that wilt, a dress that's worn once. I don't know anybody that's made a habit of just wearing their wedding dress around. A cake consumed in an hour. Some of you guys are like, no, I put it in the freezer and a year later we had a piece. And we're like, I can't count that. We're not counting that. No one in their right minds calls it wasteful though, because significance has redefined the math. Today we're going to look at the beauty of extravagance and when it's not wasteful, but warranted. To start, we're going to just do kind of a character study on this woman named Mary. Mary, the first time we encounter Mary, it's in the Gospel of Luke, Luke chapter 10, where Mary and Martha, who have a home together, probably the family home, and Jesus is coming to hang out with them in their home. And Martha is doing what the first century gender stereotype would prescribe, that she is making the meal in another room, but Mary, always breaking custom, is sitting there at the feet of Jesus Christ, performing, doing what a rabbi or what a disciple would before a rabbi. Mary is taking the position of a disciple. Taking down, you can imagine, she's got her moleskin out, she's got a pen, she's taking all sorts of notes on every single word that Jesus is saying. She can't get enough, she's devouring it. Luke chapter 10, 39 reads like this. She had a sister, this is Martha, had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said. This is a picture of Mary. Take note of what the posture of Mary is. She's kneeling. She's before Jesus. She's on her knees. She's before him in this posture of reverence and curiosity and information. Maybe you can relate to this. For those of you that have been following Jesus for a long time, maybe you're new to following Jesus, maybe you found yourself in a position where you're just like, you're downloading all the podcasts, you can't get enough, you're opening the scriptures, it feels like you're stepping into a new world and everything is just like now in this, it's like 4D all of a sudden. You're like, you didn't even know there was another dimension, but it's like beautiful and amazing and you want more of it. Can't get enough of it. This is Mary. And the second time, though, we see Mary, there's a shift. It's in John chapter 11, verse 20. And what's happened is, it's just right before the passage we read, what's happened was that Lazarus, Mary and Martha's brother, died. And Mary and Martha both know that if Jesus would have come sooner, he wouldn't have died. At first, we see Mary draw near to Jesus for information, for inspiration. But now we follow the thread, she draws near to Jesus for explanation. But at first, she's not even there. In John chapter 11, verse 20, we read, "When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home." Ever been in a situation like that where your heart is broken and you can't even get to church? You can't even go to the Bible study. You can't even imagine meeting your friend for coffee because you know that they're gonna ask you a question that'll crack you open and you don't wanna cry again because there's been so many tears already and you're staying home. That's where Mary is. Maybe you've been there. Well, what happens is that Jesus goes and he finds her. And in verse 32, chapter 11, verse 32, we read, "When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him," or Mary finds him rather, "she fell at his feet." Notice what she's doing. She's at his feet again. What does she say? "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Now, this is a beautiful picture. It's worth sitting with for a second. Because Mary is doing two things that as followers of Jesus, for every follower of Jesus, we can take note of. First, where is she? She is kneeling at the feet of Jesus once again. But just because she's demonstrating her reverence, her respect for Jesus, that doesn't mean that she can't share difficult questions or ask difficult things of Jesus. Some of us maybe have grown up in some type of tradition where we can't actually voice our frustrations to God, or it's said that, why bother God with our pain? That's not true. It's not what we see in Scripture. We see Mary, she does take on a posture of reverence, but she says, "Why weren't you here? Where were you? If you were here, he wouldn't have died." Now, she doesn't know that soon Jesus will raise him from the dead, but she doesn't also let go of what's happening in her heart. Here's what happens. When you don't vocalize the pain in your heart to God, it will ossify and calcify and become and harden around your heart. And you'll wonder, like, what happened to that tenderness I used to have? What happened to that? What happened to that softness I had towards others and I had towards God? What you've done is you haven't given voice to the pain, and so it's hardened inside of you. Mary becomes a picture of how to grieve and pray our pain while staying in a posture of reverence. But the story continues to develop. We see she draws first near to Jesus for information, inspiration, understanding. Then she draws near to Jesus for explanation. Where were you? Here in the passage we read today, she draws near to Jesus to worship. Her brother had been raised from the dead. And she is filled with this sense of just her imagination, her prayers have been answered. She cannot contain it. What does she do? She grabs the biggest non-cash asset the family has, this pint of spikenard perfume. Now, spikenard perfume, you can still get it today, actually. It's made from plants that are found at the foothills of the Himalayas. And can you imagine the 1,000+ miles between first century Jerusalem and the foothills of the Himalayas, and the process of making the perfume? It's a very low yield that you can, when you reduce the plant to get the smell out of it, doesn't produce a lot. You have to use a lot of plants to get a pint of spikenard perfume. It takes a lot of time, and then it takes a lot of time for it to move through the trade routes all the way from the Himalayas to Jerusalem. That's why it's so expensive. And Mary knows that I have this non-cash asset that will help me and our family when there's a drought season. When there's a time where things are really lean, or when there's a disaster, there's an earthquake, there's a fire, I've got this thing of perfume, but her mind is set on it because Jesus Christ has done something greater than any disaster she can imagine. The disaster already happened. Lazarus died, and Jesus brought him back. So she reaches for the thing that's kept and cared for and protected. She reaches for that. She runs, and she again goes low at Jesus' feet, pouring out this buoy against a drought season, this protection against a disaster. She pours it all out there at Jesus' feet. There's a unique gender element here too. Maybe if you remember John chapter 4, for those of you that are familiar with scriptures, how Jesus or the disciples are confused and wonder, what are you doing talking to this woman? He spends a lot of time talking to the Samaritan woman at the well, and the disciples come back like, what are you doing talking to this woman? You see, it was in the first century Jewish world, and still today in the Middle Eastern, it's very uncustomary for a rabbi or a religious teacher or any man to be just caught talking one-on-one with a woman. And so John chapter 4, that situation pops up. But here, Mary takes, she the head covering is off of her hair. And where's her hair? It's out of a bun. It's free flowing. And she's down there on her knees before Jesus. Once again, she's taking her hair and she's using her hair to clean Jesus's feet. She's poured this expensive perfume out. And the feet, you know, the first century feet, they're not clean things. So she is taking the dirt of Jesus and taking it on herself in her own hair and spending all of her wealth on this man. She's breaking custom again. She did it there in Luke chapter 10. Martha's like, come on, get in the kitchen. That's where women go. And she, no, not Mary. She's doing the same thing again. Extravagance often breaks through the boundaries. It breaks through the customs. It puts a box in place and blows the walls out of the box. That's typically what extravagance does, and that has happened with her. And you see that there's been this discipleship development in Mary's life where she's moved from curiosity in Jesus and desire for more information and good religious teaching to crisis and confusion and where are you to now costly love. Costly love. I just want to, pastoral aside, this might be what you experience in your pursuit of Jesus. You may experience times where it just feels like there's so much learning and it's all beautiful and you're blown away, and other times where you're like, God, where are you? And other times still, and hopefully increasingly, the longer you walk with Jesus, where you see him in season, out of season, irrespective of your situation, as the worthy object of costly love. There's a discipleship progression here that shows up. But what we see, the principle of what we see here, is that significance always provokes extravagance. Something significant has happened in Mary's life. She has been the recipient of a significant act that Jesus has done, and she has responded with extravagance. Significance always invites expressions of extravagance. The wedding ceremony is one example, going back to one that maybe you and I are familiar with. If you've been married, it's a significant thing. It invites extravagance. I remember, when I was a relatively new follower of Jesus, and I was in college, and, God was working powerfully in my life, and I remember wanting to lift my hands in worship, and I was, very afraid of that. Maybe you can sympathize with me. Maybe not. But I was so certain that if I lifted my hands, a spotlight would show on me and everybody would be watching me, and it would be kind of like, Brian, what are you doing, with your hands up? And it's like, and other people are doing it too, it's a little easier now for me, but I remember moving to the point where I was so compelled by the work that God was doing in my life, delivering me from a life pursuing all sorts of dead ends, delivering me from drugs and what have you. And I just one Tuesday night at the college group I attended, lifted my hands, and it was like the angels were singing, oh, and I just felt like, Lord, you can have it all. I don't care what the voices in my head are saying about what everybody else isn't saying, but I think they're saying, God, it's you are worthy. What was happening in me? Just extravagant gesture for me at that time, but significance. The significant things that God was doing in my life, it invited extravagance. Some of you I know, God knows the heart, so some of you like worshiping with your hands in your pockets, and I don't know your heart. I know you like your pockets, but but for me, this was this mark of extravagance. Oh, God. Extravagant gestures, here's the thing, is extravagant gestures will always invite questions or critique from some people who don't understand. I was guilty of this recently with the Seahawks parade. What's the deal with this thing? Shutting down Seattle for... Some of you were there. You understand. I didn't. But this is what happens. Extravagant gestures will always invite questions or critiques from someone or some people who don't understand. It's okay. So enter Judas. Here's a painting of Judas by a Polish painter, Okun. And if you know the Judas story, he got 30 pieces of silver for turning state's evidence against his rabbi. And he's wearing his betrayal like a crown. But he is not excited. His face is downcast. This fascinating insight, our bodies tell the story of our emotions. Did you know that? So his body is telling the story of his pain and his shame. The scriptures say that when Jesus Christ died, darkness swept over the land. And what we see is that darkness is sweeping over the land. And Judas, he is in the shadow himself. And it is moving across the lit land of Jerusalem. And you could almost tell he's wearing the shame with his body. But here is before that. We don't know much about Judas. Enigmatic figure. But he does speak here. John chapter 12, verse 4. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. You can imagine Mary. It says something about her. She feels safe before Jesus. She lets her hair down before Jesus. And here is Judas coolly sitting back and pointing his finger at her. What are you doing? This is what I call the cynicism of Judas. The cynicism of Judas. Cynicism makes critiques and has opinions but has no skin in the game. Cynicism is like a sniper. You're able to knock down everyone else, but you're not exposed yourself. You're not vulnerable. It's easy to become a cynic. And cynicism is unfortunately it's very common in our world. And it often sounds smart. But if you listen to a cynic, you'll find that they have lots of opinions, but no convictions. Cynics have plenty of the opinions. They just don't possess any convictions. They don't have any skin in the game. Now, just to kind of help define cynicism a little bit, cynicism is not, I've got questions. In fact, questions are really good. Cynicism is not, hey, I'm wrestling with some doubts about this. Doubts can be really helpful. Cynicism is not, I'm hesitant. In fact, throughout this process, you know, of Good Grows Here, I've met with people on our board, people in the congregation, and where we've talked through hesitancy, doubt, and questions. And usually those three things are indications of actual conviction and significant care and wanting to protect the thing that is really important that God is using. And different people are, some people are farther ahead, some people are slower behind, some people are more hesitant, some people are more ready. That's not what we're talking. Judas is cynical. Cynicism is different. And John, it's almost as if this Bible is inspired, you guys. John is contrasting these two people. He's giving us these two pictures. He's saying, there are two ways to live your life when it comes to following Jesus. You can be merry, always at Jesus' feet, forgetting about what is customary because the one who is truly significant is right there and he's worthy of everything. Or you can be Judas, sitting coolly back, having a little plan on the side, and poking holes in everyone's devotion. Now, there's a line, maybe you've heard it, scratch a cynic and you'll find a hurt romantic. So cynics, what they don't really need to be chided so much as they need healing. Mary gives us the pathway to avoid cynicism in John chapter 11 by kneeling before Jesus, but being honest about her pain. Cynicism happens when we go through the motions with our faith and we don't speak what is actually happening in our heart. And so we develop this process of the hardened heart to deal with the actual pain of living. So many people speculate there was some type of pain, some type of disillusionment that Judas had nursed that Jesus didn't fulfill, but Judas never voiced it. Now, maybe I'll just speak for myself. I can relate to having a little Judas voice sometimes in my head and having a merry heart and feeling conflicted. I remember a couple months ago, I mentioned a couple years and years ago of me wanting to raise my hands, but feeling anxious, feeling nervous, wondering about image management. What happens if the girl over there that I happen to have a crush on sees me raise my hands? What will she think? Well, just a couple months ago, sitting here in the front row. By the way, one of the reasons I sit in the front row is so I can only bless the Spirit of God with my vocal intonations. If you, like me, want to sing loud but also want to bless only the Spirit of God, then you're welcome to the front row. I'm there, and you know, God was working in my life. I was sensing a greater level of healing. In areas where I was anxious and insecure, and there were significant things happening in my life. Do you know that pastors, God continues to work in their life? Did you know that? Just let you know. And so I wanted to fall to my knees in worship, and that old little Judas voice was like, "Well, what is everyone going to think when they see you kneeling down in the front row?" you know, pastors are supposed to be put together. And kneeling, that's a little. I ended up kneeling down, but I know this voice too well that talks about how can you curate, how can you manage. It is a cousin, if not directly, is cynicism. Now, naming this is important because next week is Commitment Sunday for Anchor. Possibly the biggest Sunday in Anchor's life, marking a significant moment in Anchor's life, where we're inviting everyone to come with this commitment card. We have extras. I know you're running. Howard, and to make your pledge towards the good that God is growing here. And I just want to name that some of us might have to wrestle with that little bit of cynical voice as we continue to talk with whoever we need to talk to about making some type of pledge, some type of expression of extravagance based upon the significance of who Jesus is and the significance of what God is doing in this place. Two things that are important caveats. The first is that extravagance is not reckless. If you're living paycheck to paycheck, your extravagance will look different from somebody who's not living paycheck to paycheck. I remember when I was graduating high school, Megan Olson got a brand new Camaro for graduation. God bless her. I got a 1969 F-250 that wasn't mobile. But part of the extravagance of my father giving me that was that the $900 of that truck was counterbalanced by all the child support he'd paid over all the years and his teacher's salary, him trying to put all these things together, and the desire that he had for us to together turn this immobile truck mobile as we worked on it, father and son, with the hood open. It was extravagant. Extravagance is dependent upon capacity and love. It's dependent on your situation. There is no comparison in the kingdom of God, and there is no shame at all. And this is one of the things that Jesus mentions about the widow's mite, that extravagance is dependent upon, is relative to capacity. Just another note here, if you happen to be buried in consumer debt and struggling to make it month to month, not able to pay for basic necessities, Anchor's pledges to you. That's why we have Anchor Cares. It's why we arrange our budget so we can make sure people are cared for. If you need financial stewardship training, we can make that available. And so next Sunday, if that's you, I would just ask you for your pledge to be a prayer that you pray regularly. Now, if you're able to give significantly, according to whatever that is, we want to call you towards extravagance because what God's doing is significant. But extravagance, from the kingdom's perspective, is not reckless. Second thing is, if you can't see the significance, be cautious with the extravagance. What I mean by that is, throughout these weeks, if you've been here, if you haven't been here, if you don't understand the vision or if it's not compelling to you, I would actually warn you against making a pledge. Because obligation without understanding will breed resentment. And we want to uproot resentment here in Anchor Church. We want to call people towards extravagance based upon significance, based upon appreciating what God has done and believing that he will expand what he's done. We don't want to say, you got to do it. It's something you take before the Lord and respond to him. Those caveats mentioned, look at Jesus' response when Judas makes the criticism. You remember what he says? Leave her alone. He looks at Judas, coolly sitting back, cynical, critical, and he says, leave her alone. Elsewhere, it says, she has done something beautiful for me, and it will always be told. It will always be told. And it still is being told. Extravagance. It says the smell of the perfume carried throughout the room, and the smell of her act continues to carry throughout the church. Devotion is a beautiful picture, and it shows up in the heavens, and it shows up in history. Jesus defends and receives the extravagant acts of worship that happened then, that happened now, because he is truly the significant one, and he knows what is done for him. He is worthy of the worship that people extravagantly offer him. So, I want to invite you towards an extravagant act next week to find wherever the perfume is. If you've seen the significant work that God's done in this place, if you've been a recipient of the significant work Jesus has done in your heart, find wherever the perfume is and offer that as your pledge. We'll be coming forward after communion next Sunday, and there'll be small little buckets. You'll be take communion, put it there, the pledge in there. Your information will be safe. It'll be a deep bucket. You're fine. And we're excited to see what God does. You know, I've asked a couple people that are early pledgers, people that have kind of said, yep, we're in, we prayed about it, here's what we are called to give. And I asked a couple people just say, hey, why'd you do that? Why'd you give? And here's a couple responses. We're excited to join in what God is doing, one wrote, at Anchor. We can't think of a better long-term investment. That word struck me. They see it as an investment. Then making room for families and raising up the next generation of Jesus followers. Thank you for inviting us to give back to God generously out of the resources that he has entrusted to us. Another early pledger said, when we were asked to participate in the Good Grows Here campaign, we were instantly excited. Yes was already the answer. We love seeing God moving and growing his church, and we're blessed to be a part of it. These are people that have seen the significance and are giving extravagantly. One thing before I walk off the stage today, I mentioned this at some point in this process, but Tacoma Lions Church, those that built this building in the early 90s, have architectural drawings on that field that says, worship center. This was going to be the kids' space, the rec center. In fact, if you look at those vertical shaped sound panels, those, you flip it around, they're basketball hoops, actually. This was going to be a place where kids were playing, and when we ripped it up, but it was a gym floor in here. And I just, you know, the money ran out, the church closed, but you know, God hears our prayers. And one generation's prayers might not be answered in that same generation, but God might answer the prayer of one generation in the second generation. And isn't that like God? He's got his own timing on things. So I just invite you, if you smell the significance, if you can see the significance of who Jesus is, what he's doing in here, would you give out of extravagance and silence the voice of cynicism? Prayer's available, communion's available. Come, come all and when you're ready.